guest this week last appeared on the podcast in the transitional year of 2020, and as you are well aware, an awful lot has happened since then. And because our guest is nothing short of a human dynamo, he's been up to a lot as we've catapulted forward into the dizzying third decade of the 21st century. He's a communications industry entrepreneur, the co-founder of Blaze Media, who's made his mark on radio, TV, and live events, not to mention being a 13-time number one best-selling author and one of the few in history to have had number one national bestsellers in the fiction, nonfiction, self-help, and children's picture book genres. He's also a humanitarian who's raised significant funds for a number of charitable causes, including helping families in Afghanistan and Ukraine, as well as fighting sex trafficking around the globe and more. As an elite nationally syndicated radio talk show host, his passionate, informative, and entertaining conversation attracts millions of listeners on more than 400 stations nationwide. A Radio Hall of Fame inductee and Marconi Award winner, his quick wit, candid opinions, and engaging personality make him a must-listen for legions of fans. 2022 marks the 20th year that his show has been in national syndication with Premier Networks. Our guest this week is Glenn Beck. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Glenn Beck. Glenn, welcome back to the Michael Harrison Interview. It's been 2 years since we last had you on the show, and I'd say a few things have happened in this time. Here we are in 2 years into the third decade of the 21st century, and you, my friend, have been syndicated by Premier Networks for 20 years. Hard to get your brain around that one, isn't it?
I know. I mean, I can't believe how fast it has gone. And it's been, gosh, from, you know, September 11th, I think most people probably feel this way. From September 11th, it feels like five separate timelines, mm-hmm. you know, five different lives. It's changed.
How do you feel differently today than you did, say, 2 years ago?
How do you mean that?
Do you think things are getting better, getting worse? Are you happier? Are you more optimistic? Are you tired? Are you invigorated? You know, what's the world like to you as a human being at this point, and as an interesting human being?
Strangely, I'm more optimistic, but things are getting much worse, and I think it's going to get much, much worse before it gets better. You know, we haven't hit bottom yet, but people are starting to wake up in the country, and they're starting to wake up all over the world. A little concerned about what it means to be on the right side in Europe, because that has typically meant fascism. But I'm not convinced that at this point, that's where they're going. I think people are just waking up that it is the people versus the elites. You know, I am more optimistic because I think people are realizing all over the world, wow, wait a minute, this is not just my country, and it's not just, you know, a Democrat Republican thing. This is happening all over the world, and this is we're struggling with a viewpoint from the elites that they can control and manage everything, and we'll live the life they want us to live. And I just don't think Americans are going to be there for that.
As a very bright man, and following your career for so many decades as I have, I know you before you were syndicated. And you were a bright disc jockey at one time. So, I mean, you've always been ahead of the curve. Do you ever stop and think anthropologically or in terms of the DNA of the human condition, that maybe it's more about the way we're wired and leadership? Because you said something very interesting, that sometimes it's a little nerve, you know, it makes you a little nervous with the right because of its connection to fascism.
Of Europe.
Does it ever just make you nervous that when the elite overthrow, when the regular people overthrow the elite, that there'll be a new elite running things?
Yeah.
That's what worries
me. It absolutely does. I mean, this is why our founders wanted the power to be with the people, because, you know, power in and success and fame. I've said success and fame are battery acid to the soul, but so is power. And, you know, you can get the best people in power, and then all of a sudden they start believing they're the elites. I'm very concerned. You know, life and society is a pendulum, and it swings from one extreme to the next. And we're best when we're in the middle. And right now we are in a we society, a we cycle. And that becomes very dangerous because it becomes about the collective. And if the pendulum is stopped here, we're in real danger. But the pendulum is starting to swing back, and I think people can feel it. But it'll take 20 years for us to get back to the middle, and then another 20 years to get to the me generation again. This is a very dangerous place, and I've said it for years. It depends on who's in power when the event happens that will force somebody, or they'll think they're forced, to grab the pendulum and stop it where it is.
Mm. I don't think anybody can stop it, but it's in the attempt to stop it that we wind up getting herky-jerky, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's that's how you end up with authoritarians.
Yeah. Well, do you see danger here in America in terms of the right and authoritarianism?
Not as much on the right as the left, but I do think all sides have... It scares me, you know, I learned this from Martin Luther King. It scares me when somebody says, you know, they just want to beat them. They just want to win. We can't have that mentality in America. We have to come back together. Now, that doesn't mean we come together with the people who are literally trying to overthrow our nation. I don't want to come together with, you know, the people who really were serious about, you know, killing Mike Pence or whatever on January 6th. There's no place for them at the table. And there's no place at the table for those who hate America, want to destroy it, and have actively engaged in that. But the 80, 90% of us that think we're enemies of each other, we're really not. We just have to rediscover the things that we have in common that always kept us together. And that is human rights. The rights given to us by God, the things that we used to find self-evident. Right now, they're in question, and mainly being questioned because the elites are saying they don't exist, or they don't exist the way we've always understood them. But they do, and that's the truth, and we'll eventually come back to that. But if you are looking for, I'm going to win, we got to beat them, that is going to lead to half the country being a loser. Mm-hmm. We're experiencing that right now with the Biden administration, and it could easily go the other direction. But they're saying this whole half of the country is an enemy and a danger to the country. Well, when you play that out, where does that end? Where does that end?
It ends with
rounding people up.
Yeah.
Either side could do it.
It ends with seeking victory at the expense of truth, which is what's
correct.
Going on. It happens
correct.
In the media. Do you think the media is feeding this? With targeting audiences, giving them the red meat they want, as opposed to taking the chance to tell them something they may not want to hear?
Yes.
That's what I see.
And
as
I think
a problem.
I think we all wrestle with that to some degree or another. I mean, the willingness to lose your following is very low. You know, if we self-preserve, it's what we do. Once we start, though, saying, I have to preserve my voice because who else will do it, so I'll compromise. That's when you become a problem.
Is Donald Trump a problem for the Republicans and for conservatives at this point? Because it seems to me, trying to be an objective observer and being as fair as I can, you know, in my role as publisher of Talkers and, you know, just keeping an even keel and believing in the First Amendment, it appears to me that there's been this daily dance of affirmation, this problem, if you will, that conservative talk show hosts and conservative politicians and Republicans have with Donald Trump. It's an abstract concept, but I know you know what I'm talking about. What's mm-hmm. your take on that from your observations and from your own experience?
So, you know, I was very against Donald Trump until I saw what he did when he was in office that proved me wrong. I never thought he would do the things that he did. And I was very concerned about the rhetoric and everything else. And I still am. I don't like the rhetoric. You know, he'd have 4 years. I don't know what a Donald Trump does in 4 years, except probably go after the deep state with a real passion. And so that, in some ways, that makes him good and also warning it could be dangerous, because if it's personal, then we don't get justice. That you know, makes me nervous. I am torn on Donald Trump, and as I think a lot of people are. A, if he's the candidate, I'm voting for Donald Trump. And I think most conservatives feel that way, that we cannot allow another term with a Democrat. The way we're going, I don't know how we survive to 2024. So I would vote for Donald Trump. However, I would much rather have somebody that doesn't have the baggage. This is an interesting balance point. Somebody that doesn't have the baggage, doesn't have the hatred of Donald Trump, but has the passion and the understanding when he hits the ground. Donald Trump learned a lot, and he will not hit the ground running the way he did before. Believe me, he knows what the problems are. And he's one of the only people, I think, we know for sure he is not afraid to take it on.
Do you think that he'll slither through all of his current legal woes and actually have a chance to run again and be a player?
I said to him two things. First of all, they're not going to stop until you're in jail. I mean, they don't care how you get to jail. Hook, crook, doesn't matter. But they want you in jail. There's a real hatred towards him. However, I don't think they're going to put him in jail. I don't think you're going to find anything on him. If you really look at this historically speaking, name anyone on planet Earth that has been investigated more than Donald Trump. And I don't mean just from American investigation, but the press globally. Every intelligence agency, probably in the Five Eyes for sure, and then outside all of our enemies, everyone has looked for something on this guy. If they have to make things up to try to get him, I think this is shocking to me, and I've said this to him. He did construction in New York. How do you do that and you're squeaky clean? How is that possible? But if they would have had something on him, it would have been found now.
Yeah. I find it hard with the American system of politics to get to any kind of a meaningful office and remain squeaky clean. You can't be that naive and still hold the office. It's a vicious cycle. It brings out the dirt in people, the very system. And that's something we have to consider. Let's switch gears to your latest book. What is your latest book? You've got like 13 number one bestsellers. Yeah, yeah. I can't keep up with you. You're such a prolific author.
Thank you. The latest one actually just came out today, and I didn't write it, but it's Mercury, Inc. Mm-hmm. And it's the eighth book in the Michael Vay series, which is a young adult series that I just love and shepherd through. But my latest is called The Great Reset.
What is The Great Reset about? A lot of people talk about it as if everybody knows what it means, and I find most people don't have a clue. So could you give us a quick overview of what The Great Reset means and where you stand on it?
So it is something that we started investigating, gosh, almost 3 years now. And honestly, I thought it was going to come back as a conspiracy theory, that there would be something there, but not what everybody was thinking it was. Remember, at this time when we started investigating it, no one really knew what it was. And it was only, you know, kind of kooks that had said anything about it. So we started doing our investigation and we looked at the, you know, kooks, as the world would describe them, and said, let's see if we can find any of this. And then the only sources we used were the words of those involved at the World Economic Forum, the World Economic Forum itself, the speeches given at the World Economic Forum, the Paris Climate Accords, and all of the different treaties that had been signed. And then as soon as Joe Biden got into office, we started using whitehouse.gov, the treasury.gov, and it is so clear that this is a global effort to completely reimagine the West, to get rid of capitalism as we know it, and to replace it with something that is technically fascism. It's private-public partnerships with giant corporations where governments set the pace and say, this is the future. For instance, cars. I don't know if most people know this, but every car company, with the exception of, I think, Bugatti, is going to be making all electric cars by 2030. By 2035, that'll be your only choice, except maybe Bugatti. And some of them might change back if things start to look differently. But the governments of the world have said fossil fuels are not our future. And so then they worked with the car companies of the world and said, look, you really need to go this way. And they leaned on them. And that's the way it is all going to be. If you saw what happened in Russia, you know, you and I, Michael, we've been watching, you know, coalitions of countries coming together to fight whatever other country. Mm-hmm. We've seen it our whole life. But I had never seen the coalition of the world's Western giant corporations come together and stop doing business like they did with Russia. It was staggering, the number of businesses that came out and were stating no business ever with Russia and were closing shop in Russia. The only one that didn't do that was McDonald's. McDonald's said, we have billions of dollars there. We have infrastructure. We have employees. We've invested since the wall came down. We're not just walking away from it, but we support the Ukrainians. It was about a week later that they came back and they said, our reputational risk is too high. And so we are closing our stores and we're joining the list of everybody else that's boycotting Russia. The key words there are reputational risk. That is a sign of ESG. You're leaned on by the banking community, by insurance, by anybody else who is big in the financial portion of ESG, and they say, we're not sure we can loan you money in the future if we can't count on you here. I mean, you're standing with Russia. That's clearly not the future. And so McDonald's could come under fire, and that would pose a risk to our investors and to us as investors. We don't think we can do business with you.
So you see the Great Reset as the next step in something that many people have been fearful of for years, and that is globalism. in a situation whereby the big corporations join forces to bypass government and become a force as big as, if not greater than, government.
Well, they work with government.
Right, but it, so it they control right. government in a way, don't they?
Yeah, but, you don't really know who's in charge. Is it the banks? Is it the media and social media, the giants with all of the information and power at their fingertips? Is it the government? You don't really know who's in charge because they're all just kind of working together.
As a guy who's pretty much a visionary, as you are, and I sort of engage in appreciation for visionary thinking, do you think in this new world in which we are rapidly catapulting, we're just like moving forward into this new mm-hmm. world where electronic communications threatens our privacy, it threatens everything that we do, do you think it's possible for us to have the kind of freedom going forward in this new, in this brave new world that we've enjoyed in the past, in the analog era and the time when the United States was founded and the principles that built it? Can we even expect to have that kind of freedom going forward?
Can we expect it? No. Should we demand it? Yes. There are things that we could do, but we keep signing up for all of these things because they're convenient.
Mm.
You know, when every device can map and track everything in your home. I remember and I thought this was a good thing at the time, but how foolish was I? Right after 9/11, somebody from intelligence came in and gave me a briefing on something. And they were talking about how they could track terrorists and that they are watching certain terrorists and they're watching electricity and water usage. And they knew what the water usage was for one person, two people, four people. And if those people that were living in one house or apartment, if the water level dropped, they could see one person is not there, three aren't there. None are there. And then they immediately went to all of their connections that they had made online or through intel gathering, you know, human intel gathering. And they would go and check the water usage of all of their friends to see did their water usage or their electricity show that there is another person there. At the same time, they would track all of the trains and all of the planes to see did anyone fitting this description go. And they said, we can find them almost immediately. And I thought that was amazing at the time, but that's when I trusted our government.
Right.
That's what we could do in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what we can do now.
Yeah. The forensics of it. Everything yeah. is can be brought into the lab or into the, you know, the algorithms or any number of ways.
And when you – there's two things that are really concerning. When you have deep fakes in both speech, which is really hard, but we are very close, speech and visuals – it's you can spin somebody doing something that they never did easily. And unless you have the tools on your side to prove it, you know, not being true, you're screwed. The other thing is I've been in a fight with the federal government. And if they choose to give the information, you can win. If they choose not to give the information for quote, national security reasons, mm-hmm. you're screwed.
Yeah.
You're screwed. You don't have equal access. They know more about you than you know about you.
See, I feel at this point, they, whoever they are, know more about me and us than we can even imagine. I think privacy is dead. And I've always felt the First Amendment was the foundation of American democracy and American freedom and Americanism. But now I realize that privacy really equals it, maybe even supersedes it. If you don't have privacy, if you can never escape, you know, I sound a little cliched here, the eye of Big Brother, as Orwell predicted, And that's an abstract concept. Big brother is watching you. Well, then you can't have freedom ever on any level because they can get you.
Right. And not only do you not have freedom, and this is big in the ethical and philosophical conversations now currently. If you don't have privacy, you also then lose free will, because you won't be able to distinguish your free will from those things that are being put in front of you, and your choices are being shaped. So if you are thinking about, going on vacation, and you've had one conversation with your wife about going on vacation, it knows where your wife wants to go on vacation, where you want to go on vacation. Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking just for business purposes. It begins to search and look for the thing that would be for both of you. That would be great. And you'll start seeing ads for it. Or when we get digital assistance, they'll say, hey, we already booked it and we've cleared your. So did you decide to go to those places, or were those choices just put in front of you? And that's when propaganda becomes extraordinarily dangerous.
Very much.
Because
so.
You can get people to vote. You can get people to kill. You can get people to spend, and they don't know it.
I see that same process happening, in terms of an environment nudging you to thinking you have free will when you've been nudged there and don't even know what the scope
Correct.
Of your possible will is. I've talked to a number of reporters over the years that call me for my take on politics and media, and I say to them, well, you're biased. They go, oh, no. I said, well, your newspaper is biased. I'm not saying that is an insult. It's part of targeted media. It's the way, oh, no. And then they always say the same thing to me. And you've heard this line before. No one has ever told me here what I can write or not write. Mm-hmm. I always say to them, that's because you are so programmed that you don't even know what you could write.
Oh, yeah.
Am I right? Yeah. Have you heard that ever said? No one ever tells me what to say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wishful thinking.
I mean, I've said it. I've said it before. I mean, years ago, I've said that before. And I will tell you that I've worked at CNN and at Fox.
Yes.
And they neither side told me what to say. One side told me what I couldn't say. Mm-hmm. But neither side ever said, you have to toe the line on this. Neither side. But I knew the parameters
right.
of the business. I knew what the parameters were. I knew if I wanted to go in a certain direction, I'm going to have to get this past all of these people who will have all kinds of legitimate objections to it, mm-hmm. and it will just stop and go nowhere.
Because you're smart enough not to be self-delusional. But it's amazing to me how many people think they're smart and think that they are free and unbiased and are completely self-delusional at that and operate within that parameter.
I think that, though, Michael, is because on the left, it's easier to become delusional because you're not challenged by anything that has teeth. You're challenged by people like talk radio and podcasts, and that doesn't have the real teeth that that they have. You know what I mean? They have the institutions, and the institutions are not challenging what they believe. Wow, They're all reaffirming each other.
Well, you just brought up a very sensitive topic, and I'm going to probe you on it real quickly. What you said about challenged by anything with real teeth. I am often interviewed by the so-called mainstream media, and the premise of the interview is to get me to say bad things about conservatives and talk radio. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm not about to do that. Mm-hmm. And it always
comes. Well, you should if it's an honest thing.
I'm talking about broad strokes general talk radio is the reason our nation is divided and our culture has become toxic. And and that we know is not true. And I also have problems with the mainstream media explaining that public radio is radio and it is a counterpoint to the conservative side of commercial talk radio, which is and that in if you look at the whole picture, it all evens itself out, which is my perspective that you should not get rid of conservative talk radio. You should add liberal talk radio to it if you want to. There's no reason to shut anything down. But that being said, here's the point. I often say, why? And I do this very in danger to myself as a trade publisher in talk radio. I say, why do you think that talk radio is so powerful that it could do this? I say your premise is wrong. They go into it the premise that these corporations that own talk stations are making millions of dollars feeding this swill to the public and changing the course of history. And, you know, I remember when I started Talkers 32 years ago, I was saying, talk radio is powerful. It's influential. Take it seriously. But now it's like, whoa, you're taking it too seriously. Does that resonate with you, what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does. Because they can't. You know, look, I am the guy after 9/11 when Bill Maher said, hey, at least these pilots had courage. Our pilots don't. Do you remember that statement?
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly.
From Bill Maher.
That's what got him in trouble with politically incorrect.
ABC? Yeah. And I remember saying on the air, what part of politically incorrect did ABC not understand?
Oh, gosh. While
I found that offensive, really deeply offensive, I stood up for him. And on talk radio, that was not a popular standpoint. Should have been. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to find the place to where we are saying, I will die for your right to say it, but I don't have to agree with it. And we don't have that anymore. And the reason why talk radio is so powerful is because there is a vacuum. When there's a vacuum and you can't get what a lot of people are thinking and want some kind of understanding for what's going on that makes sense to them, if you can't get it on the mainstream media, the free market will put something up. The problem with NPR is it's bogus. It is being funded by the government. Now, if that was really, truly a competitive and needed view, it would be able to stand on its own. But every time they've tried to do talk radio, there's no hunger for it. And it's been explained a billion different ways. I don't know what the answer is other than there's no market for that. There's just no market for that. The reason why I think PBS is or NPR is as successful as they are is there are for a long time people really believed that they would consider all things. They don't consider all things. It's groupthink yet again. But it is couched in kind of this snotty, elitist know-it-all that you feel smarter for listening to it. And I think that's a part of their success.
And part of that whole elite thing that you were talking about at the beginning of the conversation. Look, I can go on with you for hours. In conclusion, I understand that you have been involved in a number of humanitarian efforts through charitable work and through your companies. I'm going to pick one. And I'd like to talk about the Russia-Ukraine war. What's your take on it? How have you become involved in helping families, et cetera? Where do you think it's going?
I don't think it's going anywhere good. I think, you know me, Michael, I'm a guy that always has an opinion on where the world is headed. Mm-hmm. And about 4 years ago, I made a list of seven or eight things that you had to watch for. And I said, I don't know in what order they will come, but the last one will be a global war. And all of them have happened except for that last one. And the reason why I put that one on is because it's the easiest way, when everything is collapsing, it's the easiest way for politicians to change everything. And if there's pain, people will accept it more likely if there's a war. So they're fighting against something. And then when the war is over, you never really return to where you were. And people just generally will say, I don't care. I just want that to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, this is my gut, and I pray I'm wrong on this, but it just feels to me like our side is itching for war. And it's incredible to me that we are announcing everything that we're doing for the Ukrainians. I mean, down to the last bullet, we have announced we're sending this and this and this. Everyone knew that Russia, when they were fighting Afghanistan, that America was there. But we didn't say exactly what we were sending. And the same with all of our allies and all of our enemies. They don't spell it out because that is there comes a place to where you're like, this is a proxy war. You know, if you're going to fight like that, then, you know, we're just do it out in the open. And Putin is a cornered guy. You don't want an animal like him cornered. We've cornered him. He's in trouble in his own country. It would be nice if they took care of it themselves. But, you know, it's not exactly a free nation. And for us sending money over to Ukraine without a single accountant is the height of fiscal and fiduciary irresponsibility. It is it's craziness. And I think the world is in danger with what is going to come from this.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with radio talk show host, multimedia personality, communications industry entrepreneur, prolific author, contemporary cultural visionary, and master showman, Glenn Beck. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, check out mhwrap.com. I also have a cool music video that I produced with the group Gun Hill Road. It's called Idiots and can be seen at idiotsvideo.com. Check it out. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.